Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Presenting Christ through the same-sex marriage debate. Right, I'm sorry, one of our guys, he likes drawing cartoons, so he's a bit silly. Right, the same-sex marriage debate. How do we get here? I accept there's a distinction between Western and Eastern Europe, and between different countries. So let's just take that on board. But within the space of 10 years in Western Europe, we have gone from a position where virtually no major politician would accept same-sex marriage and where it would have been considered ludicrous, to now, at least in the United Kingdom, if you don't accept it, it's unlikely that you're going to be able to progress politically. And in other ways, too. It does seem to me just completely strange how we got here. And one of the ways that we got here, and I don't have time to go into detail on this, it's something called queer theory. Now, that's not a derogatory term. That's the term that was developed by the people themselves, late 1960s, early 1970s. Queer theory came out of the New York Stonewall riots, in other words. And the idea behind queer theory was both to desexualize human beings, to destroy the family, to change the whole concept of marriage, which was considered to be patriarchal and oppressive. What has happened is that there's been a change in the gay activist community as well. Somebody like Peter Tatchell, 11 years ago, wrote a major article attacking those homosexuals who wanted to get married, saying it was ridiculous. Last year, he was one of the main advocates for it. I did a debate with him on Revelation TV, which lasted an hour and a half, and he admitted that he had changed his position. I actually don't think he had changed his position. I think he thought that same-sex marriage was going to get what the queer theory folks wanted in the first place anyway. That is very destructive. But there's another aspect of it. Does it really matter? You know, there are some Christians who are obsessed with this issue. And I'm always concerned when Christians are obsessed with anything other than Christ. And I always think there's a wee bit of a problem there. Other Christians will say, well, yes, it's the end of Christendom, and I'm saying you made a mistake, guys. Christendom's gone anyway. Does it really matter? You get other Christians who go to almost the opposite extreme and say, no, it doesn't matter. All we've got to do is just love people and proclaim Jesus, which sounds good. But my neighbor's starving. I love them by providing them with food. Biggest cause of homelessness in my city is dysfunctional and broken families. And I think, yeah, it really matters. The same-sex marriage debate matters for Christians, not because we feel that we are going to be persecuted, but because it affects our societies, and in particular the poor. I've always argued it in public as being an issue about the poor. I think it really does actually matter. I'm saying how we present Christ, and I'll come on to that in a moment, but when we're arguing this, first thing that you're doing is, as a Christian, and we're talking about discussing this with non-Christians, you don't stand up and say, the Bible says. Not least, because if they know something, they're going to go back with, yeah, but the Bible says this. And you've got to think about what's involved with that. So I would always argue from the aspect of nature. Now, it's very interesting that people say, well, homosexuality is natural. And I go, yeah, so is rape. So is murder. You don't necessarily go that route. But in the terms of human nature and what is involved, it's a fairly obvious thing that one thing that a same-sex marriage cannot produce is children. They'll say, oh yeah, you can be parents. I say, no, can't produce children, not without the intervention of a third factor. And that is hugely significant and hugely important. Another is the question of history. It is not without significance that human society has largely turned away from that the concept of same-sex marriage. Now, it is not strictly true that it's never existed. I was reading in one of the early church fathers one of the Greeks complaining about the Celts, that's us, the Scots, who marry their mothers, and the Persians who marry their brothers. So that's a very interesting thing from the past. I think from a Christian perspective, from a historical point of view, we would argue that in actual fact, before Christianity came along, Greco-Roman pagan culture was profoundly sexually dysfunctional, and families were a real mess. And when Christianity came along, it changed all of that. And that Europe has for 1500 to 1900 years held to a Christian view of marriage, and that we're about to give that up. Does that mean that we are progressing? No. My argument would be that we are regressing back to a Greco-Roman pagan view. So that impacts upon society. What do we care about marriage? Who cares what two people do in private? Yeah, but except same-sex marriage debate is not about that. It's about the recognition and redefinition of what marriage is. The British Prime Minister, when he decided that it would make him as a conservative look more liberal and nice and kind, he said, "We are redefining marriage." And that's exactly what he was doing. Marriage is redefined for everyone. Every marriage becomes solely a civil contract. Whereas in Christian teaching, marriage is something very different from just a civil contract. And that has an enormous impact upon society. And as I suggested earlier, it has an enormous impact upon the poor. My argument would be that what you tend to see happening is a kind of middle-class bourgeois moralism or view of morals permeating through society, through the media, through the education system, and the people it hurts most are the poor. The way I describe it is this. We do discovery camps with kids from some of our housing schemes. And I remember speaking to one kid who's, I said, "Look, can you go and, I never say your mum and dad, because like that particular camp, 19 out of the 20 kids didn't have two parents at home. I remember saying to this kid, "Can you go and tell your dad?" And he said, "Which one?" I said, "What do you mean, which one?" He said, "Well, I've got my Monday dad, my Tuesday dad, my Wednesday dad, my Thursday dad, my Friday dad, and my weekend dad." What? His mother had a different guy stay over every night. This kid is going to grow up confused all over the place because of a distorted view of humanity, sexual relations, and marriage. And it does affect everyone within society, but I think it particularly affects the poor. When we're debating this, and I do, this is back to the listening thing, always ask questions. The first and most basic is, what is marriage? What do you mean by marriage? Because the trouble is, you go to most young people in Western Europe, and probably a lot now in Eastern Europe, and you say to them, "Are you for same-sex marriage?" That's not how they think about it. Because the majority of people in Scotland, for example, were against same-sex marriage on the opinion polls until they changed the wording. The wording of the question became, "Are you for equal marriage?" Well, doesn't that sound a whole lot better? Yeah, we're for equality. Why not? If two people just want to be together, what's the problem? Yeah, but why do you call it marriage? What is actual marriage? And it's absolutely amazing. I have not come across anyone yet on the opposite side who is able to tell me what marriage is. They try, but they're not able to define it. And it creates enormous problems. Another question to ask is, what is sex? And again, I think within our own context, we need to be aware of that. Lots and lots of people are being brought up with the attitude that is, sex is just appetite. You have an appetite for food. Well, you feel hungry. What do? Go out to McDonald's. It's just there. You can go. It's reckoned that in the United Kingdom, at least, most people don't go 2 hours without sticking something into their mouth. It's the same in the US, you know, because people, you know, gluttony and all the rest of it. But it's just there. It's an appetite, and you indulge your appetite. Well, what if sex is just an appetite? So I'm in this hotel, and I'm walking down the room to my corridor, and I see a nice-looking woman and say, "Well, you know, I've got a sexual appetite. Why not?" Well, That's what people think. There's an article in our local newspaper last week. Average student in our city has 6 or 7 sexual partners whilst they're at university. One girl was being interviewed, and she was quite open about her name, didn't bother. She'd had 60. She says, the only thing I regret sometimes is if I wake up in the morning and I don't know their name. Well, what have we done? We've started copulating like rabbits. We've misplaced the idea of sex. Now, the trouble is that within the Christian church, sometimes people have taught the idea of sex as dirty, and we have to turn around and we have to say, no, that's not the case. We're going the very opposite. We're saying it's very special. Another question to ask is, why does it matter? Why is this so important? Why did suddenly every political party put this in there? You know, and also the strange thing is, why in France did 2 million people go on the streets to protest against it? I thought France was supposed to be liberal and left-wing and all the rest. Well, not now. Not with the Front National and so on. But, I mean, it was a strange thing. All these people protesting. Surely you just live and let live. Another one is, why has the gay rights movement changed its mind on same-sex marriage? That is a huge one. Everyone now talks about same-sex marriage as though it's the obvious thing. If you're a nice person into equality and so on, you're going to be for same-sex marriage. Well, I just simply say to people, were you for this 10 years ago? And most of them say no. Well, why? What's happened? Weren't you a nice person then? Great question. What's wrong with people being committed to one another? I think that's a very serious question. What kind of commitment is involved? So you ask questions. You present the consequences. I think there are consequences for current marriages if the whole marriage system is redefined. There are consequences for future marriages. There are consequences for children. There are consequences for society. And there are consequences for the church. I think that is a... We have to think about what those possibly could be and what they might be. We need to take back the language. How language is used is very important. And far too often I find Christians being reactive towards that. We need to do what Paul did, which was he baptized the Greek language and gave it new meaning. Well, that's what happened. I mean, think, in English, the term gay, it used to mean happy. Well, it doesn't mean that anymore, obviously. But we take back the language. We've got to use the buzzwords that people use. It was a stroke of genius for people to say, are you for same-sex marriage? No, let's change the question. Are you for equal marriage? Because the minute you say, no, I'm not for equal marriage, that just sounds wrong and feels wrong to say that. So you've got to learn to use the right buzzwords. I think, for example, tolerance is a great word to use. And I sometimes really mess people's heads because I say, I am against same-sex marriage because I'm for tolerance. And they go, what? How does that work? And that, I think, you use their language. Use what some people would call liberal concepts, like tolerance, like equality, like diversity. I argued in the politics seminar, the law and politics seminar yesterday, that equality and diversity are not secular concepts. They are Christian concepts, which without Christianity could not exist in Europe and will not continue to exist. That equality, for example, comes from the fundamental teaching, not that all human beings are by nature equal, because nature doesn't teach that, but rather from the Christian teaching that the soul of the slave is as valuable as the soul of the emperor. And that's where our equality in teaching comes from. And we need to know that. And we need to use things like that. Use non-Christian writers and non-Christian speakers. When I got involved in these kind of debates, I've got a whole list of quotes and things from gay rights activists who are opposed to same-sex marriage, non-Christians who have different perspectives and different viewpoints. Because you're not standing up and saying to people, you must do this because the Bible says this, because we're expecting you to act like Christians. Now, how do we present Christ in doing this? Well, the first part thing I would simply say is that in showing that you have a coherent worldview and that you are not acting from bigotry or homophobia, which, by the way, you must always, always dissociate yourself from. I wrote an article about President Putin once, how I was totally opposed to some of his gay legislation. And it was quite funny because I had some gay rights people said, "Well, Dave, we don't like your views at all, but thank you for this." You know, and they thought there was a consistency that was in there. But I think you're, on one level, you're showing as a Christian you're really thinking about it and what's involved. But we present Christ, first of all, in our manner, how we do things. I don't understand why Christians would stand and yell at people. That doesn't make sense to me. Which I'm defending Jesus Christ. Well, he doesn't need you to defend him. He's the King of Glory. I mean, what do you think you're doing? Well, I'm standing up for him. No. You're yelling at people. Why? Don't yell at them. Be robust. Be strong. So our manner is very, very important. I was in a debate with a gay rights activist, and he asked me about the homosexuality issue itself, and I said, "I can't answer it, that question." He said, "Why not?" I said, "Because for you, it's your identity." I said, "I bet you at school you were bullied." He said, "Yes." "I bet you were thrown out of church or whatever." And he said, "Yes." And he said, and I said to him, "I'll bet you that for you, you say, you go, 'Hi, my name's Paul.' And the next thing is, 'I'm gay.' I said, for me, I don't go, 'Hi, I'm Dave, I'm heterosexual.' And what I do is, you know, I'm first of all a human being, then I'm in Christ. There's, you know, I'm a father, a husband." I said, "To be honest, probably even being Scottish comes above my sexuality and my identity. I don't know. But for you, it's the number one issue. It's the key issue." And, you know, we were actually engaging. We were actually talking with one another. And I said to him, "I won't endorse what I would consider to be sin and what the Bible says is sin. I'm not going to do that. And I'm not going to shy away from telling you that. But I'll tell you this. You are always welcome in my church." And at that point, all the LGBT people in the audience, which was about half of them, the other half were West Indian Pentecostals, stood up and started clapping. I thought, "That's really weird. Of course he's welcome in my church." And then I realized, they don't think that. They think I hate them. They think I'm against them. But I'm not. I'm no more against them than I am against you for being greedy or for talking too much like me or, you know, lots of different things. And I think it's quite important that in our manner, we do that. In our content as well, we present Christ. And what I mean by that is we have to think a whole lot more deeper about the issues that are involved here. Going back to the guy I was just telling you about, our identity. That's the key issue here. What is our identity? And if we don't see that, we're missing the big picture. And you're trying to get the big picture because it's Christ that fits into the big picture. So, it was quite funny. That particular debate, as I said, it was half West Indian Pentecostals and half LGBT activists. And one of the West Indian Pentecostals stood up and he said, "I'd like to ask the panel, what is your only hope in life?" And my opponent stood up and he said, "Well, I'm a liberal Democrat politician." He said, "And my hope is to raise the tax threshold to £10,000. And I looked at him and went, "That's your hope? Get a life? That's all you want?" I said, "I'm sorry to use jargon, but my hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness." And all the West Indian Pentecostals stood up and went, "Yay!" You know, "Hallelujah!" And I was going, "Oh my goodness, this is great." But then I said to him, "Look, let me explain what that means. It's about back to your identity as a homosexual." I said, "My identity is I'm somebody who's made in the image of God. And I think you are as well. And I want you to be whole." And I said, "I know that you're thinking right now, I can only be whole if my sexuality is accepted and if I'm allowed to express it and so on." And I'm saying, "No, that's not wholeness. Wholeness is a different thing." And I think in our content, we're able to present Christ if we're thinking about what is involved. I mean, I found it quite amazing. I've done quite a lot of these debates. I've become a little bit more reluctant to do them now because I've kind of become known for doing them. And I've not done them to try and make a political point or to try and get people to vote in a different way. I do that by writing politicians or discussing with them. My primary aim in doing them has been, I know that I will get an audience who wouldn't come near a church. And I will get an opportunity through... It's difficult. I accept this. This is probably the most difficult one to do this. Because it's so emotive and so personal and so pressurized and so aggressive and so angry people get all the time. But it is possible to present Christ in that and to say, well, listen, you can think about... There's more to this debate. There's a guy came up to me after one of these debates, and this was in a Baptist church, and he came up and he said, all right, Dave, I'm not convinced. He said, I'm gay. I'm not convinced, he said, but which part of the Bible should I read first? Because I'm going to find out more. So I think there's possibilities. Just a couple of things to mention, and we're done, in terms of books. The first book, Rosaria Champagne Butterfield. This is an extraordinary book. This is a woman who was a lesbian lecturer in, I think, Syracuse University, New York State, who, in one line of the book I'll never forget, she says, I got out of the bed of my lesbian lover and went to Syracuse Reformed Presbyterian Church to hear, and the story of her conversion. And it's not the classic, you know, I was converted and everything. It was how she wrestled with, and how she wasn't accepted by two communities initially. Both her former gay rights community and the church. Brilliant, brilliant book. Highly recommended. Thomas E. Schmidt's Straight and Narrow is still one of the best books that you can get on the whole homosexuality issue. There are a significant number of new books that have come out. Walking with Gay Friends is a very, very, very good book. There are a group of Anglican ministers who are homosexual and celibate evangelical Christians, and they have a very powerful testimony as well. I put some other resources up there. There's an Edinburgh debate, what we call Flea Bites, which is a wee talk I gave on the subject. We made a submission to the Scottish government, but I think most of all, the debate with Peter Tatchell, the supreme gay rights activist in Europe, is probably the most interesting for you. So, I'm just saying it's possible, and I'm saying if you're going to talk about this issue, do so in the broadest possible context of seeking to introduce people to Jesus Christ. Let's leave it there. Oh, excuse me. Right, guys, questions or comments?
What do you answer if the opponent asks you if you believe that homosexual can be healed?
I would say that I don't accept. Now, some Christians don't agree with this, but I don't look and say, okay, you know, homosexuality is an illness which you can cure. And I don't ever advocate people to go for therapy on that basis, particularly the kind of therapy which I've seen happen where some men who are gay are shown pictures of naked women and so on trying to... I just think that's absurd. I think... I would always say to someone, look, life is very, very, very complicated. So if they said, do you believe homosexuals could be healed? I would say, well, that's implying that homosexuality is a disease, which I don't accept. However, what I'd want to ask you is, do you believe that people can change? And they're going to buy into the narrative, which is, no, we're born that way. You know, Lady Gaga, born that way. Actually, the most common classification right now amongst the LGBT community is bisexual. And I would say to them, look, I know people who have changed. I know people who have changed from being heterosexual to homosexual, and I know people who've been changed from being homosexual to heterosexual. So then the follow-up question to that is usually, do you believe that people are born gay? And I say to them, I actually don't know. I personally believe there's a genetic predisposition to a lot of things within us, and that may include sexuality. I never buy into the line, God created me that way, because that's like saying, I've got a bad temper, God created me that way. There could be a genetic aspect to having a bad temper as well. There's a genetic aspect to alcoholism. I'm asking, not what's your sexuality, but what do you do with it? That for me is the key issue. So I never get into that kind of... I usually say, I don't know enough. When I go back to Dundee, I'll be sitting with a guy who is struggling with his sexuality. I can't say to him, it's the way you were brought up, or it's just because you're sinful, or I've got to accept where they're at. And normally, if I meet LGBT people and they say I'm gay, you know, a guy comes up and says, hi, I'm Andrew, I'm gay. And I'll go, hi, I'm David, I'm hetero. Guess we're not going to get it on. What was your point? So it's really, you know, I mean, I focus particularly on this and the same-sex marriage thing, but obviously the homosexuality thing will come up as well. Can I also make a warning here? There are too many Christians who rely on the yuck factor. Ugh. You can't bring that in to any discussion or argument. I think it's really wrong to do that. To bring in what I call the yuck factor. Ugh, homosexual. Ugh. It's wrong. You may personally find it quite disgusting or nauseating. You may not. That's completely irrelevant. And you must never, ever bring that in. Any other questions? I've got to repeat the question, which is not really a question, but just saying, basically, you get to know gay people and you treat gay people the same as everyone else, as human beings, which is I'm agreeing with. This interview with Keller, he is asked by a professor at Columbia University, do you say that I'm going to hell because I'm gay? And his answer is just spectacularly brilliant. He says, no more than I'm going to heaven because I'm heterosexual. And he's correct. I think what you're doing with people is, why would homosexuality be the standout sin? What if your neighbors are greedy? My neighbors are Muslim. What if it's a crooked businessman? What if they don't have the same politics? You know, I mean, come on. You treat every single human being as made in the image of God. The theology that we have tells us that's what we've got to do. We also treat every human being as being, if you'll excuse this phrase, bent and perverted. Not, I don't mean in the sense of sexuality, though that comes in to it, but just by nature of living in a bent and perverted universe and us being sinful. So everyone is a human being made in the image of God, and everyone is in need of salvation. And the primary need for a homosexual is not to be cured of their homosexuality or whatever. It's for them to be forgiven for their sin, all their sins, and to come to know Christ. And so therefore, you should not treat the homosexual any different than you would treat any other person. And I think that's very, very, very important. And that should come across. I mean, it's tough sometimes. I mean, I'm doing it in a debate situation, and somebody with whom I profoundly disagree and who is profoundly hurt by what I say sometimes. But if you treat them with dignity and respect, it can work. You know? I mean, I remember one person, I get a lot of hate mail, okay? I get a lot of hate mail. And there was one time there was a thread ongoing on Facebook about how evil I was. And a gay rights activist wrote in and said, no, you guys have got this wrong. I don't agree with David and his viewpoints on sexuality and Christianity and everything. But he said, I can live with him. You know, that's not a problem. And, he said, you're wrong. He's not a homophobe. And I think the trouble is with the homophobia accusation is the minute people think if you're against same-sex marriage, you're homophobic, you can't argue against it. You know, but I don't let people away with calling me a homophobe. I said, well, why would I be afraid of homosexuals? I'm not. So, yeah. I mean, I think of another couple I know who were a couple of missionaries, and they were a bit scared because the area that they moved into, they said that their next door neighbors were both lesbians and they had a wee girl playing with their girl. What were they going to say? And both myself and my wife looked at them and said, actually, that's a tremendous opportunity. You treat them as human beings. You care for them. And I said, you're not going to go to their wedding or whatever because you don't agree with it. It would be patronizing and wrong of you to do that. But you treat them as human beings. If you read Rosaria Butterfield's book, you'll see that's how she was won for Christ, because she was treated as a human being. And somebody actually bothered to think as well about where she was at and what she was doing, which is also important. Anything else? The question was, what would I do if somebody comes to me and says, I've struggled with homosexual feelings and so on? I would first of all take it seriously, and I would say to them, what would you say to me if I told you I struggled with heterosexual feelings? In other words, a lot of young students in my congregation, beautiful young women, and I find myself maybe attracted. What would you say? And I would ask him that. and try and help him see that the biblical position is, just because you might feel something doesn't mean you should immediately go and act upon it and do it. So I always, when I get asked the question, I was in a bookstore in Glasgow and the manager stood up and had a go at me because he said, "What about homosexuality then?" And I said to him, "Why are you asking me that question? We're talking about God and science. Is it an accusation or is it a genuine question?" He said, "It's an accusation. Why are you such a homophobe?" I said, "Well, that's interesting because you don't know me. I haven't spoken about this. You don't know. You're just assuming." I said, "And to me, that's prejudice. However," I said, "I will answer your question if you answer mine." And I said, "Then we're done. We're not discussing this because this is not what it's." And he said, "Okay, what's your question?" I said, "My question is, do you think there is any form of sexuality that is wrong?" Now he swore at me. He said, "You clever bastard," basically. That's what he said. And I said, "Whoa, why am I that?" And he said, "Because if I say no, you're going to say, what about pedophilia or what about bestiality? But if I say yes, you're going to say, how do you know?" And I said, "You got me. I'm not the only clever so-and-so here." I said, "That is true. That's exactly what I was going to do. So I'm telling you right now, this is my position. Number one, I believe homophobia is wrong. There's no need for me to be afraid of or hate homosexuals. Number two, I happen to believe as a Christian that there is a God, that he created us, and he created us male and female. Number three, I'm IKEA man. I can't make furniture. All I do is follow the maker's instructions. So for me, that's the same with marriage. Number four, God says sex is special, should be within marriage, and marriage is between a man and a woman." And I said, "Number five, I actually believe that that's sustained and been the basis of our society for almost 2,000 years. And I said, "My final point is this. I believe I have the right to hold that opinion and argue for it without you accusing me of being a homophobic bigot, because your accusation is itself bigoted and intolerant." And he just looked at me and he went, "Okay, we'll live with that." Now, sometimes you don't necessarily get that reaction. But that's at that level. But I would also use it at the individual level. I would say to the person, "Look, you're struggling with your sexuality. But there's someone else who's also struggling with their sexuality and they're straight. They can't control themselves." I would say to the person, first of all, you get your walk with Christ right. If this person's a Christian, that's, and I'm assuming that. If they're not a Christian, it's a different approach. But first of all, you get your walk with Christ right. And secondly, you might go, we've got a couple of counselors in the church. And I'd say, maybe you should go and talk to the counselors. Let's see where this comes from. That's a possibility. I might have a book for them to read as well. And I would also say to them this. I would ask them, "Do you watch internet porn?" And I just ask them that straight out. Because internet porn does, like all porn, it's like drinking salt water. It makes you thirstier. And it feeds things. So I would just ask that just blunt. And I'd say, "Stop it." And then I would say, "You and I, we're going to meet up every month to pray and, just to see what's going on." I wouldn't, go back to that question, I wouldn't try to cure them. And I wouldn't, And I operate on the principle of what Jesus said, that there's no point casting out one demon if seven come in to return. So it's really, there's no point casting out one demon if he goes away and brings back seven others. So I look... I'm not equating homosexuality with demon possession, by the way, but just the principle of the thing is, if someone's life is filled with Christ, they're going to, I almost treat it the same way as I do when a 30-year-old young woman comes and says, "I'm not married, and there's no decent men in this church. I'm never going to have sex. Why shouldn't I just go out?" Well, because that's not what sex is, and that's not what your life is, and you can have a better life than that. So... guys, these are obviously massive, massive, heavy issues and very, very serious. Obviously, I've just skimmed over a whole lot of that. But thank you for spending a wee bit of time with us. And yeah, thank you, guys.